This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So, the only thing left to say is, you win? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus, rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Welcome to another edition of Chelsea Fancast, My Chelsea, and I'm very, very delighted. And actually, I owe him a massive apology because not only was he on the list to do them in the original series we did in lockdown, but he had actually bothered to do the homework that I sent him and sent it to me. And of course, I completely ignored it, like the spanner that I am. So it's an apology to him, first of all, and it is the absolutely delightful Kelvin Barker, also known as the Shepherd's Bush Maldini.
Yes, that's the one, the Shepherd's Bush Maldini. Nothing to do with my football, just my looks.
Yes, it's those flowing locks, Kelv. That's what it is. Come on, seriously, why the Shepherd's Bush Maldini? Because I know I spoke to you about your book the other week, and I forgot to ask you then. So you have to tell us why the Shepherd's Bush Maldini.
Well, actually, I won't say, because the story of the Shepherd's Bush Maldini is in the Tales from the Shed book.
Which is a book.
Yeah, so I would say if people haven't read or heard the story yet, then they should buy the book. It's all in there.
Very good. Yeah, that's a good point. I completely forgot that in my stupidity, and it is. And that's also a good way of getting a plug in for that absolutely fantastic book. Now, you know, people who haven't listened to this before, I can't believe that there are people who haven't listened to this before. I'm obviously Stamford Chidge. I do the Chelsea Fancast with some absolutely wonderful people and reprobates. And when we got bored in lockdown with bugger all football to talk about, I thought, what can we do? And I thought, I know, let's go and ask some of the mates that I have. Mainly, actually, it started off with the Fancasters. I thought it'd be fun for people to know a little bit about how we started supporting this wonderful football club. And obviously, I've extended that out to more and more and more mates. And that's why we've got Kelvin on tonight. So, first question, obviously, Kelv, how did you become a Chelsea supporter?
Right, well, I hail actually from Northern Stock. So my dad's side of the family are Geordies. But they came down, as quite a few Northern families did during the war. So they came down as a family and settled in West Kensington just before the war started, I think. My dad was born in 1938. I think he was a baby when they arrived in London. When he started going to school, him and his mate decided that they wanted to support a local football team. And they were kind of like right in the middle of Chelsea, Fulham and QPR. So what they did was on three consecutive weekends, they went to a game at Chelsea, a game at QPR and a game at Fulham. And by the grace of God, settled on Chelsea. So, and he started going, I think around about the time that he was starting sort of secondary school. That would be right. Yeah, because he saw Chelsea win the league in 55. So yeah, he went from that sort of early period, sort of the start of the '50s, through to, I think it was 1979 was his last game for 35 years, and then he came back after that.
So how many years did he go continuously? That's quite a stint, isn't it? That's 30
years. I think it was 50. It was about 30 years to start with. Then he had a 35-year hiatus and then decided he fancied going again. So he's been to a few games since then, only three, I think. But yeah, he did a 30-year stint at the start.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's I was talking to somebody the other day, actually, on another podcast about the fact that, you know, my journey into being a Chelsea supporter is unconventional compared to most of my mates who, you know, all of whom I'm in total awe with, because they all seem to have been born into it. But yours is somewhere in the middle, in a sense. I mean, you moved, you know, pretty much to the Manor, and your dad still took you, and that's the main point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because, I mean, he obviously bought into it straight away, and he became sort of Chelsea straight away. It's a funny way, I guess, to decide who you want to support. But once they were in, I know they were going to games. He told me he used to park his bike up outside the ground and go in, and his bike would still be there when he came out afterwards, and he'd ride it home. Yeah. And then he got a job as a milkman with the Express Dairies in Goldhill Road. And there was a few Chelsea in there, so he started travelling with them to home and away games. And I remember clearly as a kid the amount of times he wasn't around in the evening because he'd gone to like Norwich and Stoke and all these sort of far-flung places. He was one of those who went to the infamous League Cup semi-final at Norwich that got fogged off with about 4 minutes left to play. And he went to the when it was replayed as well, but didn't help. We still got knocked out.
Excellent.
But yeah, he was a regular. He was home and away. He was a lottery ticket seller, or Chelsea Pools, I think it was actually. And yeah, proper right into it.
Yeah, nice one. And of course, he would have taken you to your first game, which was what?
Yeah, so Newcastle on the 5th of December 1970. We beat them 1-0. I was 5 at the time, and he took me and my brother. It was both of our first game. My brother actually would have been 7 that week because his birthday is the 10th of December. So it would have been his 7th birthday coming up. Whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know. But he took the two of us for our first game. I know that I irritated him because I was little. My brother was always taller than me. And he could see what was going on. Like, we were standing on the terraces, and he could see what was going on and I couldn't. So in the end, my dad had to pick me up. But he always suffered with a bad back from being a milkman for so long. And so for a little while after that, I weren't allowed to go. And I think I had a year or two. I think it might have been about a year, to be honest, where he said I was too small. And then I think he just, in the end, got sick of me sort of going on about it and started taking me. And it probably worked out well for him because I'm the one who stuck with Chelsea, and my brother supported all sorts of different teams at different times. And
Disgraceful.
Yeah, he don't get it. But I think ultimately my dad probably is quite pleased that he gave in and let me go back.
Well, I mean, not only should he be pleased, he should be thoroughly proud of you, because not only, you know, you're not just a fly-by-night, you know, Chelsea supporter, you know, the books I know that I'm totally biased because it's my favourite book, but, you know, you've written, I mean, Chelsea, you know, Celery supporting Chelsea in the 80s, representing Chelsea in the 80s is the seminal book on Chelsea in the 1980s. So if I was your dad and I was a Chelsea fan, I would be mightily proud, and I'm sure he is, mate. So there you go. Anyway. Do you remember, I mean, you know, five, I mean, that's even younger than, I mean, I remember I was taken to my first match, which of course was not a Chelsea match, when I was about 7, I think. And all I remember is it being shit because it was Portsmouth, and violent because it was Portsmouth. So I don't really remember much about it, but do you remember? And they were in the third division in about 1972, mate. It was bloody horrible. Anyway, I mean, do you remember anything specifically at all from the first match?
Funnily enough, I actually remember the goal. I mean, I've seen the goal, God knows how many times since, and I've got a recording of it. I've got the programme from the day. I've got the programme from the following home match. It's got the pictures from my first game, etc. But I do remember stuff about it. I remember being pestering my dad and being picked up. to watch the game. I remember the goal, and when I saw it a few years later for the first time since, I was kind of quite surprised at how clearly I recalled it. It was very similar to how I saw it in my mind. And it was a cracking goal, actually. It was a cracking volley by Keith Weller. But yeah, I do remember going in for the first time. I remember finding it quite intimidating. As I say, I was little, until I was about 16, I was very short. And so as a five-year-old, I was fairly sort of timid as well. And I do remember like all the strong language and the pushing and shoving, and it was very boisterous. And yeah, it all sort of sticks in my mind. I remember, maybe it's not just from that game, but I do remember the early days of walking down Fulham Road and seeing the floodlights, and like they just seemed massive. Everything seemed to dwarf me back in those days, you know. But yeah, my recollection of that that first game is probably one of my best memories, my clearest memories of that kind of age, you know, because there's a hell of a lot of stuff when I was five that, you know, is gone. But that's something that's always stuck with me, actually, yeah.
It's funny how it does. I mean, you were lucky enough to see, you know, what many would say is a classic Chelsea lineup. We had Peter Bonetti in goal, Johnny Boyle, Ron Harris, John Hollins, Marvin Hinton, marvelous Marvin Hinton, Dave Webb, Keith Weller, Charlie Cook, Peter Osgood, Ian Hutchinson, and Peter Housman, which is, I think, bar one or two notable exceptions, Huddy for one. Although I know you've got a slightly different view on Huddy than me, but you know, barring one or two exceptions, that is the classic 1970 Chelsea side, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I couldn't have wished for a better lineup to start with, really, could I? I mean, that's a quality side, and that is one that you cast your mind back to, and you think that's a That's that moment in time for that Dave Sexton team, and that 9 or 10 of those players were in that team for the when they were achieving stuff, when they were getting top three in the table and all that. There were some key players there, and I managed to see them on my first game. Yeah, so I can't complain.
Absolutely right, and it's interesting. I always like looking at I mean, I'm a bit geeky like you are in this respect, but I always like looking at who was in the opposition team. That's quite a decent Newcastle side. They've got Frank Clark, Bobby Moncur, Brian Robson, the bald one, not Captain Marvel. For those wondering, because he would have been very old by the time he played for England if that had been that Brian Robson. Wyn Davies, which I forgot completely that Wyn Davies played for Newcastle. Great big, bulking number nine Welsh bloke. Obviously, did he play for United as well? Didn't he, Wyn Davies, or was that Ron Davies?
Oh, one or the other did, yeah. Didn't they?
I think it was Ron actually.
Right.
Well, who was the one that played for Southampton?
Ron, I
yeah,
think.
It was Ron Davies who ended up at United. Right. Yeah, yeah. But Wyn Davies, there you go. And as Kelv said, Chelsea won 1-0. They were fourth in the League Division 1 at the time. And Dirty Leeds were top. And I think it was Arsenal and Spurs above us. Those were the days to be a London team, really, weren't they? We mentioned, you know, quite a few of the, you know, what I think the Kings of the Kings Road team. I think we can kind of ubiquitously call them. But who were your favourite players growing up?
Ian Hutchinson was my first hero, proper hero, and actually by complete coincidence, I almost wrote his biography with his ex partner after he died. A friend of mine bumped into her at some sort of conference for mentors and got talking to her. And he mentioned he supported Chelsea, and her name was Elaine Thatcher. And she said that she was Ian Hutchinson's partner at the time he passed away, and that she was like, she had some notes to put together for a book. And so this was a couple of years after I'd done Celery, I think, and he put her in touch with me, and I met her, and nothing ever came of it, actually. But it would have been quite, I don't know, it would have been almost like the stars were aligning there, my first hero, and then I get this opportunity to write the book. When I see you, actually, she'd tell me something I can't go public on about him, actually. So I'll tell you that one when I see you in person. But yeah, I think there would have been a few stories in there. She wanted it to be a book to make some money to give to his son. But as I say, we never got anywhere with it in the end anyway. But yeah, I digress anyway. He was my first hero. There was a guy called Peter Feely as well, who I can only assume scored a goal in one of the first games I went to. And I took to him for that reason. I can't imagine it was anything else, but briefly, it was like Ian Hutchinson and Peter Feely were my heroes, but I stuck with Hutchinson. And then as I got a bit older, as I went through sort of childhood and into sort of like into my youth, Clive Walker and Mickey Fillery, I like them both. I think I had a lot in common with both of them because I'm bloody lazy as well. and then once we got into John Neal's, with the 83-84 team, I think half of them I would legitimately say were my heroes, and you know, one or two of them still are, I think, really. But yeah, those kind of guys really through my sort of like early years. I'm too old for heroes now, but those were the ones when I was growing up.
Yeah, I like that. Mickey Fillery. I have a wonderful memory of Mickey Fillery that has nothing to do with his performance or otherwise on the pitch. But I went to a long time ago now. It was probably a pitch owner's dinner. Or lunch, more to the point, and you know, a lot of the ex-players were there, and we had a great day, drank far too much, blah 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 blah, and then a lot of us ended up back in the Butcher's Hook, and as did a lot of the ex-players, hoping that of course we would carry on buying them drinks, which of course we dutifully did, and I think I said Martin Wickham. Martin remembers this story because not only did I instigate, Jock Finiston was there, and we were singing lots of songs to the players, and Jock was left out and looked a bit sulky, so I started the Super Jock. Super Jock scores more goals than that wanker Stanley Bowles, la 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 la, which he absolutely loved. Martin and I were about the last to leave the pub, apart from two people, which I think was absolutely definitely Mick Fillery and probably Johnny Bumpstead.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely shit-faced, particularly Mickey. I overheard their conversation. They were like, you know, they've got those quite high bar kind of tables with the big, yeah. They were on there, and I kind of wigged into their conversation. And Mickey was basically saying, "I love you, I love you, Bunners, I love you." You know, he was such a great player, and that, we had such a great relationship. None of the others understood that. It was just the most surreal kind of thing I've ever come across. But I have to say, it really endeared them to me in a huge way, I have to say. Anyway, as always, we digress. You know what these bloody shows are like with me on them. Right, okay, let's get into the meat and two veg of this. I have to say, Kelvin, that's quite a lot of matches, but I'm sorry, it's nothing compared to bloody Meehan, who must have come out with at least 50. So there you go. But what are your favourite matches?
Favourite matches, then. The Chelsea 4, Liverpool 2 in 1978, probably. I was probably just about still a little kid. What would I have been, 12 then? That's probably the one that really stands out from sort of like my childhood. It's an amazing game. Obviously, they were European champions. We were in the first division at the time, but we were about 15th or something, I think, in the table, 15th, 16th. We had a couple of players missing on the day as well. We had Mickey Droy missing, and I think Kenny Swain and Ray Wilkins were both missing that day as well. So nobody really fancied us at all. So turning them over 4-2 that day was amazing. That was brilliant. The atmosphere was incredible. So that was, yeah, that was probably the sort of highlight of my childhood, and being able to go into school and actually brag for once, because obviously around that period, I didn't get that many opportunities to give it a big, and like most of my mates were QPR fans because I'd been from Shepherd's Bush, and school was basically in the middle of White City Estate. So I was surrounded by QPR. So they were better than us at the time. And if people didn't support QPR around there, they supported Liverpool. So for once, I could go into school and properly give it a big one that following Monday.
Yeah, I like that. Go on.
No, sorry, no.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, it's thinking that Frank Lampard riposte to Jurgen Klopp, you know, just because you won the Premier League once doesn't mean you can give it the big one. But I was going to say, yeah. Go on.
They could give it a big one back in those days because they were by far and away the best team in the country. So I couldn't say too much, really.
Well, they were, as you said, they were European champions. They were cup holders too, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. No, they weren't. Yeah. No, they weren't. No, they weren't. Because United won it in 77 against them, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Yeah.
But they this was kind of the I wouldn't say, I'm not so sure if this was, you know, yet peak Paisley era Liverpool, but I'd say it was certainly the beginnings of it. I mean, their team was Clements, Neil, Joey Jones, Alan Hansen came on as a sub, Phil Thompson, Ray Kennedy, Emlyn Hughes, Kenny Dalglish, David Fairclough, Steve Highway, David Johnson, not that one, Ian Callaghan. You know, that's a pretty decent team.
That's a proper team. That I never really understood. I mean, Bob Paisley, obviously great manager, but he switched Phil Neil and Joey. So Phil Neil played left back and Joey played right back. And I think it's, you know, Joey won't mind me saying that Clive Walker ripped him a new one that day. Phil Neil gave away Tommy Langley's goal with an absolute shocker of a back pass. Yeah. And I never really understood why he switched them from their normal positions. But it was also Joey's last game for Liverpool. Even though he had some sub appearances after that, he was sub for their European Cup final at the end of that season. He actually got substituted in the second half. And he was telling me that he went off and he had the right ump about being substituted and had the ump more than anything about the way they were playing. Bob Paisley flung a tracksuit top at him to put on. And he said he was so huffy and he was like struggling to get it on. It was a bit tight and that. And he said, in the end, he pulled his arm through it so hard and he punched Paisley in the face by the dugout.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I mean, just to emphasise what you were saying, we were definitely, as you said, Kenny Swain was missing and Mickey Droy. So we were Peter Bonetti, Graham Wilkins, John Sparrow, Ian Britton, Ron Harris, Steve Wicks, Bill Garner, Ray Lewington, Tommy Langley, Charlie Cook. Steve Finnessy came on for Charlie Cook on 34. Did Charlie get injured?
Do you know what? I think he actually went off sort of like fatigued.
Really?
I think it was like tiredness, yeah.
After 34 minutes?
Yeah. I think he was really struggling. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection of it, was he wasn't actually injured. He was just struggling.
Wow. Well, that was actually Charlie Cook's last appearance for Chelsea, which I forgot completely. Clive Walker was the number 11, and, you know, Walker got two goals. The first one was just astonishing. He just wallops it in from about 25 yards, and it swerves, and Clements just stood there watching it go in. I wasn't there, but, this was probably the match that really... I mean, I went to the Stamford Bridge in 76 to weirdly see the semi-final between Palace and Southampton. Dad took me to that. I kind of fell in love with the ground and started watching Chelsea quite vicariously on the big match, as you did. This was the match that really got me into Chelsea, I think, because it was on Match of the Day, I think, and it was just an astonishing match. I mean, as you said, we ripped Liverpool a new one. We were 3-0 up before Johnson scored, and then 4-1 up 5 minutes later, and we just played them off the park. And Walker was astonishing that day. I don't think he ever had a better game for Chelsea, really.
No, I don't think so. I think that was the one where he introduced himself. And, you know, I remember as a kid, like, watching that and walking away thinking, right, we've got a player who's going to be an England international, he's going to be this, that and the other. You know, I was, got completely carried away by all. He was an instant hero to me after that game. Even players like Bill Garner, I mean, he was a plodder, wasn't he, Bill Garner? Just a plodder. He was in and out of the team, but he sort of bullied and terrorised them, and everybody stepped up that day. Everybody, Graham Wilkins had a good game. They all put a bit in, and, you know, to do that without Ray Wilkins as well, our best player by an absolute mile. It was a great result. It was a great performance, but it obviously went exactly the way it always went with Chelsea back then. So beat Liverpool, then we thrashed Burnley in the next round and put six past them. And then we lost to Orient, you know, and that was Chelsea back then, wasn't it?
It was indeed. And, you know, I mean, we did it again, didn't we? We got knocked out by Palace in 76 when we had hopes of doing quite well. And Chelsea, we wouldn't have it any other way. So the next favourite game you got down here, Kelv, is a league game. Chelsea 6, Newcastle 0. In 1980, I mean, I can understand in some respects why this would have got a nod from you. But I suspect there's a lot more to it than just the 6-0, right?
I mean, it was just like, it was a, it's one of those that's a little bit of a forgotten classic, because it was that team. It wasn't the, if that had been played, and you know, that game was on Match of the Day, this, the 6-0. And if that had been from the Dixon Speedy era, the 83-84 team, it would be recognised, I think, as an absolute classic of the decade, classic of that era. But I think it gets overlooked a little bit. I mean, obviously, it's that little bit further away as well. So, you know, you've got to be a certain age to remember it now. But I just remember it being an incredible performance. That autumn of 1980, which preceded the whole 5 months where we only scored in 3 games and all that business, was it 19 out of our last 22 games we didn't manage to score? And last away goal in the league that season was scored in November. But that autumn that led up to that, we played some amazing football. We were really, really good. And that Newcastle game sort of kind of, that was where it peaked, I think. And Phil Driver was playing on the right wing, and he was pretty much an unknown recent signing. And he tore them apart down there. Peter Rhodes Brown was doing it on the left. Colin Lee got a hat trick. And then Gary Chivers scored the fifth goal, which came second in goal of the season. And we ended up finishing the game with 10 men because Johnny Bumstead got a knock. And rather than risk him, we just played with 10 men because we'd already brought the sub on. And I actually just had this random memory of it as well, that I was going to hospital the next day in Charing Cross. And at that time, Match of the Day was being shown on Sunday afternoons. So, like, my mum took me to the hospital, and they gave me my bed and all the rest of it. And it was like, only when I laugh, you know, I had to get my pyjamas on and all that sort of business. And then they had the TV room back in those days. So I went into the TV room, and there was a few blokes in there. And I sat in there as well and said, "Can we watch Match of the Day?" And I was like, yeah, put it on. And it was the Chelsea-Newcastle game that was on. And I was like the king of the castle. I was proper giving it the big one. Like, I was there, you know, I was there yesterday. You know, and this sort of thing, you know, it always sticks in my mind. I felt so proud of myself. they probably gave it a toss, let's be honest. But
It would have been funny if they were Newcastle fans, but
yeah.
But no, I mean, it's funny, you know. I've talked about this game, would you believe, with Gary Chivers, who you know, obviously remembers it. For the amazing, I mean, he basically started the move in his own penalty area and finished it off, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah,
yeah. He remembers that goal very, very well. It's actually in an interview I did with him, which is coming out shortly on the Chelsea Fancast. You'll hear it there. Okay, yes. So I think that's a cracking match to choose, actually, particularly with a little. It's almost like doing another version of your book, Days I Remembered All My Life, isn't it?
It gets a mention in that book, actually, that game.
Yeah, exactly.
And that story.
Yeah, exactly that. So there we go. All right, now, funnily enough, we've got another... I mean, it's, do you know, it's funny, actually, Cal, even before I'd seen this. I wouldn't have picked the Newcastle game, I've got to be honest, but I would have picked this one, the Chelsea-Liverpool 4-2, and 1-2-3... four of the next ones. So there you go. You're nothing if not consistent, mate.
Or predictable.
Well, there is that.
Or both.
Anyway, what was not predictable in any way, shape or form was the result of the game between Chelsea and Liverpool in the FA Cup in 1982. Am I right?
Yeah. And I think that one is another forgotten classic, a bit like the Newcastle game. Everybody remembers the 4-2.
Yeah.
Everyone sort of harks back to that one. Can picture the goals, you know, seen it a million times on telly. This one doesn't get shown so often, although one channel did actually show it. I think it was BT Sport showed it a year or two back. They showed the highlights of it. But actually, this was a better result than the first one, simply because we were a mid-table second division team at the time and they were European champions. And I can't remember the team off the top of my head, but I think we're talking about Ian Rush, Graham Souness, Hansen, Lawrenson, Grobbelaar. It was Phil Neal was there because he gave us another goal in that game as well. And again, like, you know, this was a proper Liverpool team. But you had Colin Lee absolutely bashing those two centre-halves to pieces. We had Mickey Droy taking care of Ian Rush. and Steve Francis in goal, 17 years of age, and repelling anything that they could throw at him. And it was just on Colin Pate's getting a better of Souness in midfield as well, man-marking him and taking him out of the game. So, you know, people stepped up to that, and there was 42,000 in the ground. Atmosphere was amazing. It was a funny one because it was one of those, you had to be in like an hour before kickoff to be sure you were going to get in the ground. So I was in the shed. I was in the middle of the shed watching the ground fill up. And it just got livelier and livelier to the point that the teams were about to come out. And then all the Chelsea went into the Liverpool end and it was kicking off in there like no one's business. And the teams came out onto the pitch. And the ref immediately told them to get back off again. But you see all the ball boys, but the ball boys had lined up, like given like a, like almost like a guard of honour as the teams came on. And so the ref said, go back off. The teams went back into the tunnel, but the ball boys carried on lined up watching the fight in the North Stand.
Brilliant.
But we beat them, and we beat them fair and square. And that was a real feather in our cap. But again, having done that, we lost to Spurs, didn't we? Albeit we gave them a game. We did give Spurs a decent game, and they were obviously much, much better than us at that time.
Well, we lost to Hoddle, really, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah, he was top class, and the other Scroat Hazard as well actually played really well that day.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were, you know, we had our glory at half time after Fillery scored that free kick, but it wasn't going to last, was it really?
It wasn't. I have you absolutely spot on 100% about that. The fact it's a shame, isn't it? Because this is never remembered, whereas the, you know, the 4-2, everybody remembers that one. And yet this was far, you're right, this was a much, much better result. We were in the second division, as you said. I mean, our team was Steve Francis, Gary Locke, Chris Hutchings, Mickey Nutton, Mickey Droy, Colin Pates, Peter Roach Brown, Kevin Hales, bloody hell, Colin Lee, Clive Walker and Mick Fillery. And I mean, we beat them 2-0. Rosie scored on 8 minutes and Colin Lee on 84. We didn't even have to bring on Alan Mays, who was the sub that day.
That's just as well, isn't it?
But you were right. You were right. Grobbelaar, Neil, Lawrenson, Kennedy, Ronnie Whelan, Hansen, Kenny Dalglish, Sammy Lee, Ian Rush, Terry McDermott, and Graeme Souness. I think, you see, that is for me. This is peak Liverpool, peak Paisley. They were at the peak of their powers at this period.
That's a great team, isn't it?
It is a great team. Yeah. I mean, that's for me is the classic early 80s Liverpool lineup when they were just cuffing everybody. It's interesting, you know, because like Gary Chivers in the Newcastle match, I interviewed Colin Pates with good old Martin King a few years ago, and Colin Pates is hilarious on what Souness said to him during and after that match. But like you and your Tales of the Shepherd, I'm not going to say what you said. You're going to have to listen to it when I re-release it very soon, but there you go. A great memory, though. Right, next one is, I mean, this is an absolute, I mean, you've tagged this one of the happiest days of your life. Jonathan Kidd is going moist when he hears this. Chelsea 5, Leeds 0, 1984.
Yeah, I've got goosebumps. As soon as you read that out, I've got goosebumps. That day was just incredible. Absolutely incredible. I mean, it was that season was the best season ever in my eyes. We'll never ever be beaten, obviously. Now I'm 57 or nearly 57, I'm not going to get a better season in my life that's going to mean as much to me as that one did. But to come from where we were the season before, our lowest ever finish, that season obviously kicked off with Derby being beaten 5-0 unexpectedly when they were amongst the favourites to get promoted. And it just never really took a dive. I mean, we had a slightly dodgy December, but there was just so much happened that season. And for the promotion to then be sealed. I mean, we went down to Portsmouth on the Tuesday night before that. And if we won, we were promoted. And obviously, like, we were 2-0 up and then blew that and drew 2-2. And at the time, sort of like felt a bit gutted. But with hindsight, it was the best thing that could have happened, because that to do Leeds, you know, dirty Leeds, 5-0 for promotion. It was just amazing. It was a fantastic day. The weather was fantastic. The team were fantastic. The fans were fantastic. Yeah, it was just brilliant. Kerry's hat-trick was right up there amongst the best I've seen. Mickey Thomas opened the scoring with an absolute belting goal, ran into the fans and had his chain nicked off of him. So obviously we had some Scousers in with us, no doubt, that day. I've never seen Cannaville's goal, the fifth one, because I was lined up round the side of the pitch ready to run on at the end of the game when he scored it. So never seen that one. But it was just a fantastic day, that one. Brilliant.
It was indeed. And I mean, there's a brilliant Hugh Hastings photograph of the Shed End on that day, which I'm sure it was this game. I know it was this game, but I got Hugh. Well, I found the photograph from one of the picture libraries. I found out it was Hugh who took it. So I phoned up Hugh and said, look, I want a copy of this photograph because I'm going to give it to a mate for his 50th. I'm going to get it framed and give it to a mate for his 50th because he's in there somewhere. And Hugh, being Hugh and a big Chelsea fan, I kind of knew Hugh anyway. He said, yeah, no worries, mate. I'll you know, you don't have to get it from the library. I'll send you a copy. So he sent me a copy. And I got it framed up, and it was my present to Marco for his 50th, and all the people who were in the fan cast at the time signed it on the back, you know. So it was a lovely touch because of course he was in there somewhere, and he loves this match too. But it was an absolutely another great memory, and Kerry's hat trick, as you said, was absolutely fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. One of his goals again, because it wasn't on telly. Bizarrely, a fixture like that didn't get on telly. But one of his goals where he got the ball on the left of the penalty area, and he was getting pushed out, he was getting pushed backwards and getting pushed across the box. So he ended up on the right hand side and just span on the ball and then just chipped it back the way he'd come, over David Harvey's head and into the corner. It was a fantastic goal. I mean, Kerry scored some good goals, and he scored some proper sort of striker's goals, you know, 2 yard punts and all sorts of goals, but I think that is up there amongst his very best goals.
He did, didn't he? He scored some really, I mean, you know, what I would call deft goals.
Mm. You know,
Sorry, go on, mate. Go on.
This was one of them. I mean, the way he was getting pushed that, and then he just like literally just stopped dead and chipped the ball back over the keeper was. I mean, put it this way: if Maradona had scored it, we'd never stop hearing about it. It was so good.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And you're right. It's such a momentous time because, of course, the following match was the Friday night. Was it the Friday night or up at City?
Yeah.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah, 4th of May up at City where we won 2-0.
That was a good one as well.
You were there?
Yeah. Went up for that with my mate Steve, it was a blinding night. It was my first time at Main Road, actually, and a bit lively. But we had plenty of numbers there. But I do remember being on a bus back to Manchester Piccadilly, I think it was, and the bricks raining down on it. But then everybody cleared off the bus and basically gave chase in the pitch black to the City fans, then just piled back on the bus and went to the station. It was a great night, though. It was quality. And we were brilliant. Our fans were brilliant that night, as well as the team.
And the other thing about that match, having scored a hat trick against Leeds, Kerry scores another great goal against City with a brilliant bit of skill set up by Canners, which I always remember. And Pat Nevin trying to stop the Chelsea fans running on the pitch, because this was on telly, wasn't it? It was a Friday night live match, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was the first time we'd been live on a league match, and it was the first time a second division match had been shown live on the telly as well. It was the first season of live televised league football.
Yeah.
They sort of broke with tradition, because when they scheduled it, it looked like it was going to be between us and City, us, City and Newcastle, I think, for second, third and fourth. It looked like Sheffield Wednesday were going to win the league, but it looked like it was basically going to be a bit of a six-pointer. By the time the game got played, City had pretty much blown it and we'd already been promoted. But at the time it was scheduled, it looked like it was going to be a really big game. So you sort of could tell of the atmosphere that night when you watch it back on the telly now. It's City are quite quiet. You don't hear much from them because they're you can tell that they're a bit down. They're resigned to another season in Division 2 at that point. And then the one time they do pipe up and they start singing about Mickey Thomas's wife, he walks straight over to them and he's like gesturing to them. And they also, you hear this sort of roar go up. And just as it happens, Pat Nevin scores his goal. And so Mickey finds himself standing right in front of the Man City fans as that goal goes in. So, you know, happy days for everybody.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Now, the next match is, you know, I think if I asked a random poll of about 100 Chelsea supporters, they'd all say, yeah, yeah, this is probably Kelvin's favourite match of all time. So much so that he actually wrote a book about it with DJ and Marco. Chelsea here, Chelsea there. It's the legendary return to Division 1, Arsenal 1, Chelsea 1, on a very sunny, beautiful 25th of August in 1984.
Cheech.
JK, in all the years you've been following Chelsea, you hardly ever miss a match, home or away. But how would you feel if you couldn't be there and it's not on TV?
Oh, Cheech, I'd be bereft, inconsolable. The thought of missing my beloved Blue Boys live. It's all too much.
I know, JK, I know. It's all a bit too much, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, panic not. NordVPN have come to the rescue.
They have?
Yep, NordVPN allows us to watch any match, even if it's not on live TV here.
They do?
Yeah, they do. With just one click, they switch your virtual location to a country which is showing the match, and they act as your cyber bodyguard whilst online, protecting your personal data and sensitive info like card details and passwords.
Oh, wow, great. But yeah, I bet that'll cost me a fortune.
Actually, JK, it's only the price of a cup of coffee per month, and you can use your account across 6 devices. It's a bargain, JK. And best of all, no more tears for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, NordVPN. I'm so happy. I could cry. Where do I sign up, Ginge?
Well, to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/Chelsea Fancast. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and you'll help support the Chelsea Fancast. The link is in the podcast episode description box. Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what can you say about that one? That was another one where actually we played Sunderland 2 days later on the bank holiday Monday, and I couldn't speak because I'd lost my voice at the Arsenal game, so I was quiet at the Sunderland game. But it was just one of those days, wasn't it? You had to be there. It was the same place where we'd been relegated 5 years earlier, and we were starting off there that season. When the fixtures came out, I don't think we could really believe our luck that we'd got Arsenal away. It was just an amazing sort of quirk of the computer. And I think everybody, you know, thought that it would be a step too far for Chelsea, except for us, who'd seen that team play and knew that they weren't going to be like the previous team we'd been promoted, that this team actually had plenty about it, and we knew we'd give Arsenal a game. I do remember, actually, that was the second time I saw a defender actually manage to get to grips with Pat Nevin. Clive Wilson was the first I saw in that game up at Man City, the 2-0 Friday night game. Clive Wilson gave him the best game he had in the second division, and then Pat didn't get the better of Kenny Sampson. That was probably a 50-50 at best in that Arsenal game. But the fans, I mean, we were everywhere, absolutely took liberties, we were everywhere. Never been reciprocated and never will be reciprocated. But, you know, there's no getting away from it. You only got to look at the pictures from that day and you can see that Chelsea are in every part of that ground en masse. Atmosphere was amazing and it felt like a win. It was a draw, but it felt like a win. And I would say to anybody, and I know we've all seen it a million times, actually, but anybody who hasn't seen it, look at Kerry Dixon's goal. Look at those fans behind that goal when that goal goes in and tell me when you've ever seen such a fantastic celebration as that. It was unbelievable on that terrace.
I mean, apart from all of that, Kelv, I don't think I've ever seen a terrace so packed. I mean, the clock end is absolutely rammed, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, people were getting carried out. And I saw a couple of like biggish blokes get carried out. People were fainting because it was very hot as well. It probably was, with hindsight, another one of these dangerous terraces, yeah. Actually. But yeah, I saw plenty of people approaching sort of kickoff and just after kickoff who had to be taken out of the ground. It was just heaving, wasn't it? it was a bit like Cambridge the season before, where there was no room left on the terrace. So there was people, when you see the pictures from it, you can see the people who have climbed up the walls at the back and climbed up the fences and are watching it from the top of the fences. At Cambridge, I was watching the game sat on a revolving spike. It was just ridiculous, but it was the only place I could get on that terrace that I could actually see the game. You know, that's how it was back then, wasn't it? But yeah, that clock end probably was dangerously full that day, but we got away with it, and it was an amazing day.
Well, what if you were there, you know, one never to be forgotten. Of course, this summer, now I'm just trying to think, I was about to go to London to go to university in kind of September. So, I had chosen to go to Ibiza with my girlfriend for a couple of weeks, obviously, you know, as you do. I mean, why would you not do that when Chelsea go back to Division One and play one of the matches that you probably wish you'd... Or, I mean, there are not many matches I regret not being at Kelf, but this probably is the one, actually.
Yeah, and funnily enough, you saying that story, it could have been me who was in that same situation. My brother had been in Atlanta and he'd got ill. And he was coming home from Atlanta, and he asked me if my parents were away, so he asked me if I would meet him at Heathrow, but it was that morning, and I actually said, sorry, mate, but I'm going to Arsenal. And so he had to I think his girlfriend went actually and met him there, but he basically had no family there when he came back, and he really was quite ill, but he's still with us now, so I think I made the right decision.
I'm sure he would forgive you completely. And to forgive myself, my girlfriend was very, very fit, I have to say. I was very much punching above my weight, I have to say.
You're in the clear then, Chidge.
Fair enough. She then dumped me, or I dumped her. I can't remember. I actually came home early because I can't remember who dumped who, but I stormed out in a wonderful kind of late teenage strop. Anyway, for the record, Pat Jennings, Viv Anderson, Kenny Sansom, I have to say, Kev, going back to what you were saying about Pat Nevin, it's hard for people to understand now when they see poor old Kenny Sampson, who's a hopeless alcoholic, bless him. But it's hard to get kids who never saw him play understand just how good he was as a left back. I mean, he was probably up there. Probably the only player I would put on a par with him in recent times is Ashley Cole.
Yeah, same. I'd say that they were a very similar level.
Yeah, he was absolutely well. No, he was world class. Anyway, so Jennings, Anderson, Sampson, Brian Talbot, David O'Leary, Tommy Caton, Stuart Robson, Paul Davis, Paul Mariner, Tony Woodcock, Ian Allenson. I mean, that is a side full of international footballers. Mariner and Woodcock, England strikers. Tommy Caton didn't play for England at senior level, did he?
I don't think so.
But he was certainly at junior level. He was highly, highly rated. David O'Leary, yeah. Brian Talbot. I mean, that's a superb side. And we were a draw was probably a fair result, but we were not made to look, outclassed at all, I don't think, were we?
No. I mean, Dale Jasper came into midfield because Johnny Bumstead was injured, and he had a really good game.
He
came quite close to scoring, actually, with a nice little low shot, just went past the post. And everybody acquitted themselves well, and obviously Doug Ruby made his debut, and there was that challenge on Viv Anderson when he put him into orbit, and we thought, like, we've signed a monster here.
Yep.
Obviously, we found out later that season that he wasn't always going to be doing. The tackle on Viv Anderson wasn't something that got repeated that often. There was plenty of times when he was getting a chase in and weren't getting tackles in at all. But everybody acquitted themselves well that day, I thought. And Tony McAndrew was on the subs bench. I don't think he got on, but that was kind of a shame, really. I know he gets some stick at Chelsea, but he was never fit at Chelsea. And would have been nice, actually, if he'd have been able to get a bit of a run out that day.
It would indeed. Great segue from Rugby here, because the match that you're referring to took place in January of the next year, same season, in the Milk Cup in a fifth round replay, Kelv.
That's one of the matches I'm referring to where he's concerned, actually.
Okay. Well, of course, there were many more, weren't there, to be fair?
There were. And the one I was thinking of when I was saying that was actually the next time we went to North London. We played Spurs in around about the October or November, and John Chidozie absolutely terrorised him. I mean, it was painful to watch. And that was where it all went downhill for Dougie after that game, because he never came back from that. But yeah, the Sheffield Wednesday one was when he gave away the penalty. But again, with hindsight, it wasn't such a bad thing, because then we had the second replay, and that was an incredible night as well. And that trilogy of games, Sheffield Wednesday, was fantastic. And the old Shepherd's Bush Maldini story actually relates to that game, which is a game I could write a book about on its own. So much happened that day, but it was one where I blagged my way out of work. And so I won't say too much because of the stories in that book, but I blagged my way out of work. I was supposed to be actually playing football for my work team. So I was allowed to have that time, but I didn't play football for my work team. I got a train. I got on the special up to Sheffield with my brother and my mate Steve. And yeah, best decision ever made, because that game was ridiculous. 3-0 down at half-time. Fans never stopped singing. Fans were incredible. We had 6,000 or 7,000 up there at less than 48 hours notice, because we'd only drawn on the Monday night, the first game. And yeah, Canners came on at half-time and scored within 11 seconds of the second half. And then he scored again with four or five minutes to go and put us 4-3 up. Then Rugby gave away the penalty, and it finished 4-4 after extra time. But then a week later, they came back to us, and we won it with the first goal in that 2-1 win. We were 1-0 down, and then Speedy scored a goal that was created for him by Pat Nevin with a piece of absolute genius from him, where he lobbed the ball over the Sheffield Wednesday wall at a free kick, and then caught it on the other end and managed to get a left foot crossing, and Speedy headed it in. And then in the last minute of the game, as everyone was preparing for extra time, Mickey scored with that header. It was just that perfect end to that trilogy of games. They were worthy opponents back then, Sheffield Wednesday. They were a tough old team, but they were plodders as well. They were dirty, you know, they fancied themselves a bit, and a bit like with Leeds and Chelsea, I think they thought they were hard northerners, and they had a bit too much for the Southerners, and they got caught out. They got found out when they played Chelsea, you know. Both the 70s team and the 80s team, they'd quite happily go toe-to-toe with them.
Mm. Of course, Mickey Thomas did go toe-to-toe with somebody in the 4-4, didn't he?
He did, Andy Blair. Yeah, Andy Blair, the ex-Coventry and Aston Villa player. It always used to make me laugh, because when you see like the Panini stickers or the photos of Andy Blair, he always looked boss-eyed. He always looked like he was cross-eyed. And in this game, he was gobbing off in front of the left. We were all on the Leppins Lane terrace, and they had a corner. I think they were 2-0 up at the time. It was just before half-time. And he was gobbing off, and you could see him gobbing off. And he was mouthing off to Mickey, sort of thing. And so Mickey threw that left hook, put him on his backside, and the whole end went up. You'd have thought we'd scored. The whole end was like cheering, celebrating, and then singing his name. And then we sort of realised that, and Mickey realised, no one had seen it. None of the officials had seen it. And Blair's flat out, you know, like Mickey straightened his eyes out for him. He's proper done him. Sheffield Wednesday players going mental. They're getting around Mickey. They're getting around the ref, and that ref asks his linesman. They ain't seen it. So just, you know, play on. They start from the corner again, sort of thing. And then in the players bar afterwards, Andy Blair had a few mates in there with him, and he went over to Mickey to have a pop at him, and Mickey was with Joey and a couple of their mates from Wrexham, and they basically sort of my understanding of it was a little bit of sort of like mouthing, a little bit of pushing and shoving, and it sort of got broken up. But no one was taking a back step, sort of thing. And the following week, when we played them in the second replay, and it was back down on our turf, the teams ran out, and Andy Blair's come out the tunnel, shouted over to Mickey, giving him a wave, and said, like, sorry about what happened last week. And Joey said to Mickey, we've got no trouble with him tonight. The arsehole had gone.
Yeah, as well as his eyes being straightened out. So yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
So maybe he straightened his arsehole out too, but I guess we'll never know. Right, so the last of your favourite matches. Well, no, it's not quite the last. There's a couple more after this. But the next one is, again, I think, an absolute shoo-in, really, isn't it? It's the Cup Final in 1997.
Yeah, I mean, that was, at the time, that was it was the pinnacle, wasn't it, really? I mean, winning the league, 85, 86, I thought we had a chance. And obviously, it didn't happen. And then it never really looked likely at any point after that. We were, you know, we were mid-table for a lot of that time. So it was all about winning the cup. And I think there was also something about having that glory of that day out of Wembley, because the FA Cup really meant something then, didn't it? I mean, it was the day that the country stopped to watch football. And obviously we'd had the 94 experience and lost that one heavily. But by 97, we had a few sort of big boys in that team, didn't we? You know, we had Zola, we had Mark Hughes, we had Di Matteo, LeBerf, Wisey. And you know, we had Ruud Gullit as manager, and they were good. They were, although they'd been relegated, Borough had some big players themselves, big foreign players. And they'd been a bit unlucky, in my opinion. I thought they were a bit unlucky to be relegated as well. It was a bit of a technicality, really, that they were relegated on for a game that they didn't play and that they had to lose points for. But if ever we were going to win it, it kind of felt that was going to be the day, because for all that they had Ravanelli and Emerson and Janino, we just had the edge on. We probably had a couple more star players than they did. And I've always felt that we'd won it from that first minute when Di Matteo scored as well, you know, which was an incredible start to the game. And everyone always remembers the whole end was doing a 10 men went to Mo and like sat down and then he scored and we're all back up again. You know, it was a mad moment, like, for everybody. It was just like lunacy in there. But I think we kind of won it with that. And I know they thought they'd equalised with a header from Festa, that every time I look at it, it looks less and less offside. But even if it had been given, you kind of thought we'd have just stepped it up. We'd just gone up a gear and would have beaten them. We were going to be too strong for them that day. And the celebrations at the end of that game said it all. I mean, they couldn't get us out of the ground. You know, those celebrations between the players and the fans went on forever. It was just a fantastic day. And the following day as well, I was down at the bridge with my mate Paul for the open top bus. And yeah, it was fantastic. Brilliant weekend.
Where did you see Di Matteo's goal from?
Right behind him.
Yeah. You could see it going in.
Yeah, it just, the moment he hit it, it looked interesting, you know, and it was just, it was almost like beyond belief that he could have scored it that early. I remember Lisa telling me, because my mate Paul, we'd stayed with them the night before, and then me and Paul had gone to the game, and Lisa had come home with Poppy. Poppy was only little at the time, and she told me, our next door neighbours support Chelsea as well, and she told me that she parked the car up as the game was kicking off. And then by the time she'd got to the front door, she'd heard a roar. And she said to Poppy, go in and put the telly on and tell me you've scored. And Poppy went back and said, it's Chelsea who've scored. But yeah, like he didn't even have time to get from the car to the front door. It was that quick, that goal. But it was just brilliant, wasn't it? It was a brilliant day.
One of the best ever, I think. And you know, really the start of what we've been experiencing, you know, for the last 20 odd years or so in many respects, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, I screwed up yet again, Kelvin, by allowing my wife to book a holiday. I think it was in St. Lucia. So I was in the Caribbean on a media blackout. Because by then I knew the error of my ways. But of course, the logic was simple. She booked the holiday in February. And I, even though we'd beaten Liverpool, it was still, we're not going to win the FA Cup. We just don't, you know. Which is another good segue, really, because this is a match where you kind of had it confirmed back in 1992 that you were never, ever going to see Chelsea win the FA Cup. So my theory is not entirely stupid, is it?
Well, sorry, I should just say, my greatest ever game was actually the first Champions League win in Munich. That actually, I think when I first filled this in, I actually said that the Bauer game was my best Chelsea moment, but actually Munich was.
No, you did. It's me getting excited by segues and getting it completely wrong.
But no, Munich was the absolute. I mean, that even eclipsed 97. But there's a fag wrapper in it. I mean, like, there was very, very little in it for me. But Munich will always be just the greatest night ever. And it, yeah, I mean, I think I've told that story. I told it on camera. I've put it in the book. It was just that even Lisa accepts that it was my favourite, my best night ever. You know, it was just brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. I mean, that was, again, it was the pinnacle post Abramovich. I think the FA Cup was the pinnacle pre Abramovich. And then once he'd taken over, then it always felt like we should win the Champions League at some point, but we were having those close scrapes and a bit of bad luck and, you know, a bit of corruption. And you started to think, well, is it going to ever happen? And then typical Chelsea, it happened the year that it shouldn't have happened with Villas Boas and, you know, the team that we had out for the final and, you know, the fact that we were losing to Barcelona with 10 men before we came back into it. And, you know, it was bizarre how we did it. But yeah, Munich was an incredible day and an incredible night. Really, really fantastic place, actually. Beautiful place. And a couple of years later, I actually went back with Lisa and the kids because I said, like, you've got to see Munich. So we went for a Christmas market and they got to see Marienplatz and that area. Yeah, lovely, lovely place. Great memory.
Yeah, I mean, it was, funnily enough, I don't know if you know Kunal at all, but...
by name, yeah.
Yeah, Kunal is an absolutely brilliant, brilliant bloke. He's in our pub WhatsApp group, which, of course, as you know, we drink in the Cock Tavern. So the WhatsApp group is known as Cock or No Cock, obviously. And Kunal was out in Munich for the England game the other week. He's a massive England fan. And he goes home and away. And he posted some pictures of where he was drinking that day. And it was the Augusteiner Beer Keller. And that's where I spent the day before going up to the match. So it brought back some fantastic memories. I mean, yeah, I think it is a hard toss-up, actually, for many of us. But I'm with you absolutely 100%. I mean, the best night of my life ever will never be repeated. Doesn't matter how many times we win it. You cannot beat the first time. I shouldn't have been there. I mean, I'm ridiculously lucky, managed to get a ticket and a flight when I had no money. I mean, it's just all everything about that game on and off the pitch was just ridiculously unlikely and serendipitous. I mean, we could all write a book. We could all write a book about that game, that day and night, and it would all be completely different. But it would all have the same theme. How the hell did it happen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know. It was incredible, wasn't it? And it was just the most Chelsea thing ever, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it?
To put it that way.
Now, here's the thing. In your little list to me, which, of course, I conveniently forgot because I went straight to Sunderland, but you actually said both Champions League finals. Now I know when you wrote this, and that would have been before we won it again. So are you you're talking about Moscow, aren't you?
I am talking about Moscow, yeah. Yeah, memorable. I think the point was that it was a memorable game. It's not a place I'd ever want to go back to, even regardless of what's going on in the world right now. But it was so bloody bleak over there. It was grey. It was miserable, like the weather. But it was Chelsea's first Champions League / European Cup final. So had to be there. It was memorable. I would imagine for the neutral, it was a fantastic game as well. But we know what happened. But it was a memorable one. I didn't get to Porto, but it would never have been the same as Munich. Like you say, you can't beat Munich now.
No. Well, I think you and I can satisfy ourselves by saying that because we didn't get to Porto. But I do happen to believe it. I mean, you did also say that your best moment was winning the cup in 97, and you're sticking with that.
Yeah, I'm not confused when I said that, actually, because, you know, that's my second favourite, and I've just had one there when I said that to you, because actually Munich is the best moment for me.
Okay, done. Now I can finally talk about the other side of that coin, and, you know, which we were talking about, you know, never ever believing that we would see Chelsea win the FA Cup. And this is your worst Chelsea moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Sunderland in 92. I've written about it in days, and I've been a bit more honest, more open than I normally am, actually. And I was in a bad place at the time, personally. And I was back home living with my parents. Between marriages, And it was life wasn't going so well, but Chelsea were doing all right in the cup and keeping me sort of going, keeping my spirits up. And then we got drawn against Sunderland in the quarter final, and we were like 5 or 6 minutes away from beating them at home. And again, typical Chelsea, we let a late equaliser go in, but still thought that we would be too strong for them up there. And actually, in many respects, we were, because we absolutely battered them on the night up there. But they took the lead. Their keeper kept them in it all night long. He was just world-class that night. We eventually got the equaliser like 4 minutes from the end or something, and we were all sort of like preparing for extra time and an even later night getting back to London. And then last minute, they get that corner and Andy Townsend wanders off from the post and the ball goes exactly where he was standing, and we lost 2-1. It hurt because it was right in front of us as well, and it was one of those where you sort of like... I'd partly love, partly hate to see a photo of all our faces of that ball, as that ball hits the net, because it must have been fairly... The look of horror on all our faces, probably quite comical, actually. But everybody had a perfect view on that terrace of that ball hitting the net. And the truth of the matter is, no one was going to tell me that night that I would ever see Chelsea win a big trophy. I walked away from there thinking it's done, it's over. I will never see Chelsea win a trophy. Not, you know, I'd seen the full Members' Cup, I'd seen Division Two, but I was never going to see us win anything worthwhile. But history tells us that I was talking bollocks.
Yeah, well, and only 5 years later, although I have to say, I think the 94 final loss was up there, I think, in one of those moments of, I don't think we're ever going to do it. Mm. You know, because that, I mean, we'd got even. I mean, I totally get it with the Sunderland match. That was the pits. But there was, I certainly had a feeling in 94, oh, man, you know, we got this close. We'd beaten United twice that season. And then it all just went absolutely tits up. And you just thought, I mean, how are we going to do this? You know, and then boom, you know, a couple of years later, thank you very much. So there we go.
Yeah.
And of course, as you said about Sunderland, it's a very long way home. And you must still have memories of the Milk Cup debacle as well, ringing around in your head. And that was a horrible time too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it was funny, actually, because the police couldn't have been more different on the two occasions. So the first occasion, and we all got there in really good spirits for that Milk Cup semi-final. Everyone was absolutely buzzing. And admittedly, you know, you're talking about 1984, 85. You're probably talking, I think almost certainly talking about the season where football hooliganism in England reached its absolute zenith. And in fact, it went onto the continent, as we know, in the following May. But it was mad what went on that season. So I kind of can understand to a point why police forces were aggressive to renowned football clubs supporters, and we were renowned for it. But what happened that night went way beyond anything that could ever be considered acceptable. You can have a bit of an iron fist, but you can't be punching women. You can't be pushing blokes off of pavements. And you cannot be walking a group of supporters, and we're talking regular supporters here. We're not talking about firm. We're talking about regular supporters, and we are talking about men, women, and children. You cannot be walking them into an ambush. And that's what the Sunderland police did that night, and they were scum. Sunderland police in that night, what was it, March 1985, February, March 1985, they were scum. And the fact that three of them got hospitalised that night is completely on them. Nobody else, as far as I'm concerned. If you go doing the stuff they were getting up to last night, don't squeal like a pig when it comes on top.
Yeah.
And and then on the way back, and as I say, I think it was February, it was freezing cold, and they put us on a train with all the windows in. All the windows had been smashed in before it got onto the platform. It was like something out of the war. It wasn't a modern train for the time. It was like some sort of thing that from the war. All the windows done in, no electricity. No heating. They knew what they were doing, and that's what we had to go home in, all the way home. And so, and I wrote about this in Celery. When I got back to Euston or wherever, and I got picked up, I got in a cab, And the taxi driver said, "You come back from Sunderland?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You see trouble at the end?" I said, "I see loads of trouble tonight, mate. I didn't see anything particular at the end." He said, "There's 3 coppers in hospital." And I said, "Well, good, because that's what they deserve." But then when we went back for that 92 game, they were the opposite. They were our mates. They were all soft and soppy. And at the end of the game, I did see it kicking off, actually. And they didn't have a clue. They were, you know, they were absolutely sort of like, "What do we do? What do we do?" You know, so something had changed there. But those 85 ones, vile, vulgar, scum.
I wonder, Kelv, if you know, everything is a product of its time, isn't it, in a way? And if you remember then, 1984, the miners' strike. Mm. I think 85 was the Battle of the Beanfield down at Stonehenge, which, you know, I was still kind of, you know, at university and coming back to Hampshire for summers and things. And, you know, I had a lot of mates. We all used to go to the Stonehenge Festival regularly. So, I mean, we were all punks in those days, but or kind of, I suppose, new wave, really, if you want to adopt a Rick from the Young Ones kind of approach. But, yeah, I mean, we knew a lot of the crusties, you know. We knew a lot of them because they used to sell us substances that I can't divulge live on air. But, you know, so we knew them, and they got the shit kicked out of them. And it was, the reason was because they sent all the police down from Orgreave and places like this because it was the miners' strike. So basically the police had, like, sharpened up their act by getting the shit kicked out of them by, you know, tough northern miners.
Yeah,
and they were like, they were battle hardened, and they just they had that, they, you know what they say when a dog, you know, or an animal, bites a human, it gets the taste of blood, you know, and it wants to bite more humans. Well, that's what the police were like in those days, and I'm wondering if there's something going on with that.
Well, I think you're probably right. To be honest, I think it all came together around that time, didn't it? And the whole Orgreave thing was another case, actually, of them thinking that they were the army and thinking that they were a bit more than they actually were. You know, they thought they were hiding behind their uniforms and their weapons, and you know, they got taught a lesson because, like you say, the hard northern miners weren't going to be bullied. And that's what they were doing. They were bullying and ridiculing these guys. And without wanting to get too political, you know, these were people who were fighting for their lives and livelihoods and their families' livelihoods and such like. But these people were up there, you know, rubbing their noses in it.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think it was a product of the time. There was a lot of that going on. But I have to say, nothing would ever excuse the behaviour of the Sunderland police that night. I mean, I just would never in a million years thought I would have seen some of that stuff that I saw that night. And I have to say also, South Yorkshire Police in the previous round, in the four-all draw up at Sheffield Wednesday, they were bullies as well. They were going out looking for trouble, throwing people into vans for no reason, like literally picking people up off the street and chucking them into vans, you know, unnecessary. People who were just minding their own business, it could have been any of us, they didn't care. But yeah, that was the place at that time. I'm not sure that they've overly changed over the years. But
well, you could make a strong case to say we're back to where we were right now.
Yes.
And I think what you're talking about is effectively the militarization of the police, or used as a government arm. And that was exactly what was happening in 84 with the miners' strike. They were used as an arm of the government, almost like a paramilitary force. It became, anyway.
Definitely.
As Ben Elton said, that's enough of politics. Right. So. Back to the football. Favourite modern stroke current players.
Right, so the modern ones, so if we go sort of, modern for me is probably anything from about 1975. I'll count Ruud Gullit and Zola as modern.
Yeah, I would.
Obviously they were great players. Then you got the spine of that fantastic Jose Mourinho team, or Jose Mourinho onwards team. So you've got that spine of Cech, Terry, Lampard, Drogba, fantastic, absolutely amazing. And obviously Ashley Cole as well, but just picking out that spine. Of the current bunch, I think Kante, he may or may not get back to the standard he was at a couple of years ago, but he has been a fantastic player and appears to be an absolutely fantastic man as well. He's absolutely lovely. So he's somebody I'm proud to say we have on our team. I also think Kai Havertz has got a fantastic future ahead of him. I know that he's inconsistent at the moment, but somebody eventually will make him consistent, and I hope it happens at Chelsea, because I think he's going to be world class. And I have to say that Eden Hazard is the best player I've seen at Chelsea, in my opinion. People will disagree, and I have to be careful, because any time I've mentioned that on Twitter, it gets into this big argument of people telling me I'm wrong and all the rest of it. It's just an opinion.
But I mean, sorry, Jorginho can't, you know, hold a candle to Eden Hazard.
Well, to be honest, if we were rating players in 2-yard passes, it would be straight thing between Jorginho and Makélélé, wouldn't it? But Makélélé knew that was you know, his role.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And we loved him for it. He did a great job. But no, in all honesty, though, I know people say Zola's the best. I personally have a 1-2-3 of Hazard, Pullet, and then Zola. Hazard did things for Chelsea that I've never seen any of the others do on a consistent basis. And you know, there's an argument that he almost won us some trophies on his own. Certainly the Sarri season, people can go on about Mauricio Sarri as much as they want, to be honest. I'm fairly sort of ambivalent about it. I don't have strong feelings one way or the other, but I certainly think that Eden Hazard pulled that team through that season. He stepped up, and you know, I don't think we'd have won anything that season without Hazard. He's the best I've seen at Chelsea, in my opinion.
You're not going to get any argument from me about that at all. But it does appear very, very tough to say, but actually, when it boils down to it, it's not. Hazard was just absolutely off the scale. I mean, like you said, he won games on his own. He could do things I've never seen anybody else do. Zola gets close for that, I've got to be honest. The amount of skill he had. But you just look at the trophies and the consistency, actually, of Hazard, to be honest. I mean, he had one duff season when they all down tools. But other than that, he was nearly always our best player, absolutely world-class, and delivered. And delivered in performances, in goals, and in trophies. It's an easy call for me, mate. Totally agree with that. Now, this is... I think I know the answer to this, but on the other hand, I'm not entirely sure. Your all-time Chelsea hero...
The good Lord Joey Jones.
Yeah.
Joey will always be my hero. He was my hero as a player, just because of the way he used to behave on the pitch, you know, the way he used to get the fans going. We'd have gone down in 82, 83 if we hadn't signed Joey Jones. We would have gone down. I'm not saying we would have gone out of business, we could have gone out of business if we'd have gone down then, because of the finances at the time. But I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that even if we hadn't gone out of business, there's every chance we wouldn't have got to the standard that we have reached had we gone down then, because we'd have been in a real bad way for a long time, I think. As it was, we stayed up. Batesy found £500,000, and everything has changed since then. We've been a decent club ever since, really, albeit we hadn't always been winning trophies. But we would have gone down if we hadn't signed Joey. He didn't keep us up on his own, but he galvanised the club, and he got some of the players who were sort of wavering a little bit. He got them on side, and he raised the fans as well. And obviously, I mean, he was a hero to me as a player. He's become a good friend, but the admiration I have for him goes beyond just what he did on the football pitch. It's the fact that, you know, he nearly died in his 40s, and he had an operation which literally did save his life. And that since I got to know him, I've always found it amazing that he is so untouched by that experience, that he just has got on with things. It's just a laugh. He's just so much fun. He's just so nice. He is a really, really nice bloke. So I have a fair bit of admiration for him, on top of like what he did as a footballer and what he did for Chelsea, more, you know, more to the point. He's just a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah, he always came across like that. I'm delighted that you chose him, and I don't know why. I think I thought you were going to choose Mickey.
Mickey knows that Joey's my numero uno, and was from that team. So even from that time when I was supporting them. So I had quite a few heroes. I loved Pat Nevin. always loved Johnny Bumstead, always loved the fact that Johnny Bumstead put his foot in and you know, really liked Eddie. But obviously Kerry, because he was scoring all the goals. But Joey was my number one. He was the one who I looked for when they came out on the pitch. And I always wanted Mickey to sign for Chelsea. He was somebody, and I wrote that in Celery, even as a kid, when I was watched him play for Man United, and like, you know, you saw the stories about him and the, like the cheeky wink when he dived for a decision I think it was at White Hart Lane playing for United, and then the other little stories about him that, and I always thought he was just made for Chelsea. So I was really pleased when we signed him. And he is a good friend, but Joey was already, before I knew either of them personally, Joey was already my number one. He was already my out and out hero. So probably see them equal as friends, but Joey is my all-time Chelsea hero.
And it's lovely when you, I mean, you know, we're both lucky enough to have met a lot of the people who were our Chelsea heroes, and it's lovely when they turn out to be even better than you thought they were. And I think both Joey and Mickey, you can absolutely say that about. So there you go. Right, final question, Kelvin. We like songs on the Chelsea Fancast.
Yeah.
So I have to ask my guest what their favourite Chelsea song of all time is.
Right, well, you know, it's always going to go back to the 80s for me. So, and the one that reminds me so much of that 83-84 season is We Love You Chelsea, We Do. It used to get sung loads. And if you look back at that Man City game, it gets a right good airing that night on the Friday night at Main Road, and occasionally still gets sung at the Bridge, and it's one that I do join. I probably don't join in quite as much as I once did. I certainly haven't lost my voice at Chelsea for a long time, but I join in with that one. Mm. I always make a point of joining in with that.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, my one of my favourites is still Chelsea.
Yeah.
Because for the same reason as you, actually, because one of my favourite seasons is the promotion season. I think it was 88-89, wasn't it? And I went to quite a few games that season because I was living in Lotts Road at the time. And even if I didn't go, I remember not going to a game, and I'd just be wandering up to a pub or something in the North End Road, and you could hear it for almost a half. I mean, it was just, you know, and it's always, it gives me goosebumps in the same way as I think We Love You Chelsea, We Do gives you goosebumps, probably for the same reason. So it's kind of bizarre, but there you go.
You know what, Chidge, with that Chelsea chant, right? They, fans of other clubs, they dig us out about it.
They hate it.
But do they really, or do they actually admire us for it? Do they actually quietly think, the way they get that going for like a whole bloody half, like you said, I think on the quiet, they actually think it's quite impressive, because, you know, it is quite impressive.
Oh, of course it is. And they hate it because they're envious and it's effective. And what they say is, oh, yeah, Chelsea, they've only got one song and it's only got one word. You know, it's that's kind of a very Scouse thing to say, obviously. But, that's the other, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the other reasons why I've always loved that song, because it fucks people off.
Yeah.
You know, it's that simple, really, isn't it? And that is the whole point of the songs, isn't it? But what a lovely way to finish, Kelv. I have to say, it's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure talking to you on these kind of things. And lovely to kind of just delve a little bit deeper on a lot of it as well, because you've got such a memory bank of great knowledge there as well. I mean, I should say, you know, apart from being a dear mate and all the rest of it, you're a fine author and you've written some absolutely classic Chelsea books. Celery, representing Chelsea in the 80s, obviously the seminal book. Chelsea Here, Chelsea There, you were involved with. There's another one, isn't there? The kind of making history and not reliving it, you were involved with. The Eddie Mack book, you were involved with.
Yeah.
Now I'm struggling a bit here, but I know you've got
Chelsea here, Chelsea there.
We go. Fancy forgetting that. I mentioned that earlier, and of course, Tales from the Shed, and of course, you've got the new book out, which is Days I've Remembered All My Life, which is only just come out. Which is, I interviewed you about the other week, but that's an absolute belter as well. So, people, go and buy Kelvin's books, because you'll be doing yourself a great service if you do. Do you want to have a final point? I haven't given you a plug. Where can you get them from, Kelv? That's probably a good question to ask.
So, they can be bought from Marco's Gate 17 website, which is www.gate17books.co.uk. And they can be bought on Amazon. And once the season restarts, they can be bought on the CFC UK bookstall opposite the main entrance to Fulham Broadway tube station.
Excellent stuff. Well, yeah, make sure you do that, people. And having just invested in, you know, in actually it's my 20th anniversary this year of sitting in gate 17. So I've just forked out a bloody fortune for that again. So hopefully I'll see you at a game sometime soon. You got any plans for coming down soon?
I'm actually going away. I didn't even realise the season was starting so early. I'm so out of touch these days. I keep doing this, but I'm going away the second weekend of the season. So I think Spurs at home
is the day
to go on holiday. As it stands, if it's on the Saturday, if it's on the Sunday, I'll get to see it.
Right.
I'm going to be in Mexico, so I'll have to get up early.
Yeah.
If it's the early kickoff, but that's what I'll do. But hopefully from September onwards, I'll be at a few games. I didn't get to too many last year because of the whole coronavirus thing. But I'm feeling a bit more confident about getting back now. So hopefully from September onwards, I'll see you all a bit more frequently.
Well, give us a shout when you come into a game. We'll hook up at the stall or something. But other than all that, Kelv, it's again been just brilliant to talk to you. I've really enjoyed, you know, sharing your Chelsea with me, and I'm sure the listeners will love it too. So until we speak again, it's been brilliant. Thanks, mate.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNuggets share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect! Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.